there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the channel. I just spoke with Megan Prelinger about her new book, Inside the Machine, Art and Invention in the Electronic Age. This came out with W.W. Norton & Company in 2015. Now, this is a beautiful book that gives us images and text and asks us to read them together and really models what reading a history of technology with and out of graphic representations can do to help us understand a really crucial and really fascinating moment in the graphic arts, in modernism, and in the emergence of technologies, electronic technologies specifically, but also how that can help us see, literally see and understand things that we might otherwise take for granted. So it's a really fascinating story that takes us from FM radio to vacuum tubes and cathode ray tubes, circuitry of various sorts, all the way into space, and really traces that history and brings out a narrative out of a series of images from magazines and journals and kinds of ephemeral sources that in STS we might not otherwise look to when trying to understand this crucial period of the history of electronic technology. So it's a really fascinating story, and it was really a pleasure and quite an honor to talk with Megan about this story. You'll hear over the course of the conversation, not just about the project, but also about the Prelinger Library and the other projects that she's working on. It's all quite inspiring, and I urge you, if you have a chance, to check those out and also, of course, to get your hands on a copy of the book. We talk a lot in the course of our conversation about images. Of course, you know, that's much of what the book's about. And so if you have an opportunity to see them for yourself in all their color and vibrancy, you'll really be able to experience the conversation in a different way. So thanks very much as ever for listening, for your support, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Megan Prelinger about her new book, Inside the Machine. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Megan, and thanks very, very much both for producing such an interesting and innovative and beautiful book and also for making time today to talk with me about it.
Thank you, Carla. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Megan, let's start, as is kind of traditional for the channel, by talking a little bit about how you came to this field and specifically what brought you to work in the history of technology and its confluence with the history of art?
It started, when I was a young person as a science fiction fan, I was kind of implicitly interested in the history of technology without, with it being narrativized in science fiction. I wouldn't have articulated it in that terms, especially as a kid. But after I grew up and studied anthropology, I was in college. I was very interested in a kind of how both narrative science fiction and the kind of evidence that I saw around me in the world I was living in formed patterns in society that didn't seem to me to be necessarily always well understood, or they were often expressed best in science fiction. And I was curious from an anthropological standpoint of how new technologies were being naturalized in our culture. And I started just kind of watching that as I was simultaneously doing lots of other things. And then again, as a younger adult after college, I decided to be something of an independent scholar because I was interested in a few different fields that didn't always know how to talk to one another. And I wanted to pursue a few simultaneous paths of inquiry. And towards that end, I ended up collecting kind of ephemera that wasn't otherwise being collected, and with my partner opening an independent research library that's here in San Francisco. And this book is one outcome of that really multi-year process of collecting historical ephemera that wasn't being collected elsewhere, searching that ephemera for patterns of how technology was being represented in the culture, and even developing a form of practice that was informed by having been a science fiction reader, where I decided to try to approach ephemeral literature as if it were a narrative, and to read it and to see what kinds of stories would emerge.
That's fabulous. And readers or listeners who will hopefully become readers will also find a lot of fascinating science fiction related stuff coming up in many of the chapters. So I'm sure we'll talk about that at least a little bit in the course of the conversation. So the book that we're talking about today identifies itself as, and in the words of the book, a history of electronics that explains technology through the lens of art. It asks the question, and again, this is from the book, what cultural history of electronics can be extrapolated from a close look at the associated graphic art? Okay, so this is not just a really fascinating topic, but it's also a really, really interesting approach to sources, right, to kinds of ephemeral art sources that you were mentioning briefly before. So, Megan, how did you come to focus on this particular topic for the book, electronics and art in this period, and to this particular way of approaching your sources and reading the sort of graphic art sources for a history of technology and to produce a history of electronics and technology?
Well, that idea of reading historical ephemeral literature as if it were a novel goes back in my practice almost 10 years, and then it led in a number of different directions. And when I say ephemeral literature, I'm talking about secondary source material, not unpublished documents, but documents that were published for industry consumption, magazines like Aerodigest, the Bell Telephone Magazine, Broadcasting Magazine, Electrical World, Electronic Age. These are some of the kinds of titles. They're, you know, they've really sort of flown under the radar of a lot of recent research because they, you know, for one thing, they're not widely collected in libraries. And for another thing, they don't really speak to the historians' primary focus on primary materials. But at the same time, they do, you know, a kind of long form, long running study of them. They do reveal all kinds of interesting patterns about the emergence of technology. And so, you know, one of the things with starting to read these magazines that I noticed, first of all, was the kind of the dialogue between text and image on the page, that the advertisements were offering one kind of story about the technology, and the straight articles were telling a different, more realistic kind of story, and that there was a creative tension there between sometimes between the utopian promise offered by the artwork and the you know, sometimes practically dystopian news of the various problems associated with technological emergence. And so that was one part of the reading, was noticing that kind of tension that's on the pages of all those different kinds of publications. And then another kind of reading was to discover that the art being created for the advertisements was actually being made by artists who were working in a mediated way, but with scientists and engineers to directly explain and explore what scientists and engineers were doing in the laboratory. And, you know, the research revealed that, you know, a number of artists were put in direct contact with laboratory scientists in order to interpret their work. And so there's a very mediated, but nevertheless real version of collaboration going on there between the artist and the engineer or scientist. And I just found that relationship to be extremely interesting and generative, and then to trace it over a number of decades. it told a different version of the story of the history of technology than others I'd seen before, working in visual terms, but very compelling.
And one of the really interesting things that you talk about in the book, again, just kind of staying for a moment more with this issue of sources, you talk about the problem of artist anonymity, right? So the book is very, very careful when it can to name some of the artists who are working in these media and to celebrate them and to bring us into their work. And, some of them were resident artists at particular labs. We'll talk about an artist who is a resident graphic artist at MIT, but names are not always available for the particular sources that you're working with. So can you talk about that a little bit? How did you navigate that as a challenge and perhaps also as an opportunity for telling the kind of story you were interested in?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's part of looking at this relationship between art and technology within a sponsored framework, the framework of corporate sponsorship, that, the companies that were sponsoring the artwork, they wanted to claim authorship for that artwork in most cases. And a few artists asserted naming rights to attach their names to their work, but not all of them had that much power. It speaks to a labor history of art for industry, which I was very interested in, and tried to trace some of the dynamics of how artists and scientists were placed together in a working relationship that was structured by the sponsor corporations. And but a number of artists were able to attach their names to work, and I was able to find them, meet them, speak with them, and hear them talk about their experiences fighting for name recognition, and also acknowledging the work of their peers that whose works had been anonymized by the system of production in which they were working. And that's part of this whole story.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, sure.
So let's get into the chapters of the book. Let's really kind of get into the case studies. Now, the artwork that was engaged in the book, and that also illustrates the book, was produced at a particular moment of what you refer to as the collision of forces in the visual arts. On the one hand, the American graphic tradition of commercial art is meeting European modernism and a vibrant and abstracted, as you put it here, new subject at the same time. So there's this really interesting coming together of very different, but not unrelated forces of imaging, of invention, of technology that's producing the works that we're going to be talking about. And what the chapters do is they take us step by step through a kind of chronological progression of the story, but also a progression of visual tropes and objects and technologies that also provide the backbone for this story. So the first chapter looks at the atom, the planet, and the tube. This is super fascinating. And it starts with the beginnings of FM radio technology. So FM is invented in 1935 by Edward Armstrong, and this technology was licensed from him by General Electric. So at the very beginning, we're in this context of understanding the competition between different electronics companies. Like, he had been doing some contract work, I think, for RCA, and then General Electric owns the technology that he produces. They see the potential in it. So the beginning of mass production of the tubes, right, for FM radio, was celebrated with a promotional booklet called Electronics, A New Science for a New World. Okay, so here we're talking about now FM radio and the tube. Now, this booklet was really fascinating for our purposes, in part because it was illustrated with something called the Earth Bulb.
Right.
Okay, so let's get right into these images. Megan, can you talk about what you find potentially most interesting about the Earth Bulb and how it kind of might help us understand the way graphic artists are humanizing technology in this period?
Oh, sure. And there's so much to say about this image. It's hard almost to know where to begin. Let me start by going back to 1909, 29 years earlier, when AT&T had articulated the goal of universal service through telephone communications. And that was the sort of initial invocation or alignment between what telecommunication could do for human society and framing it in geospatial or geophysical terms. And that idea of aligning the possible futures that electronics might bring with visual and theoretical models of the solar system has a pretty long antecedent. And then in 1938, you have Herbert Bayer, who was a Bauhaus modernist and who was known for doing earthworks and for infusing in Europe Bauhaus modernism with a sense of organic form and organic kind of ways of looking at line and form. And then here he is in North America in 1938 working for General Electric. And, you know, FM radio greatly expanded the reach of radio broadcast networks. And it was also a terrific challenge to the hegemony of AM radio systems. So the idea that FM was going to be a new world was very, you know, it was a contentious techno-political battle at the time. And then Bayer expresses all of these, the kind of encoded notion that electronics is going to pull human society into metaphors, into kind of modes of being that demand solar system visual metaphors to explain, and then that FM radio is going to be one specific instance of this kind of impact on society. And then he paints this big, it's a General Electric 880 bulb that facilitates FM radio stations with the planet Earth inside the bulb. And that image just pulls all these threads together that, and it's also a little tongue in cheek too, because it's kind of it's slightly campy, this image. But it's got the, the disembodied hands of humanity pushing the tube up into the stratosphere with the planet Earth inside the tube. And that just, it references all the way back to the idea of the notion of universal service from 1909 in the telephone sphere, and even the models applied by physicists in the first decade of the 20th century to think about the electron in terms of a tiny solar system, and brings all those kind of visual, cultural, and theoretical antecedents together in this image to promote the possible futures of FM radio.
That's right. And already, just in your description of the single image, so many of the themes of this chapter and so many of the themes that really, I think, are exemplars of the way that technology and visual representation come together are all there. So you mentioned the idea of visualizing or modeling the atom in terms of a tiny little solar system, and the chapter talks about the imaging of the Rutherford Bohr model of the atom and its relationship to the Cold War anxieties and Cold War politics. Also, the idea of the Earth inside the tube. The chapter also talks a lot about imaging of the vacuum tube as a kind of visual trope and the importance of containment that comes out just in the imaging, of this tube. So this is just one example, of the ways that paying careful attention to reading visual language and imagery can really help us understand, in a new way what's happening in terms of the history of technology in the period. And this just continues to be the case. So as we move to the next chapter, we're still looking at tubes, but these tubes are cathode ray tubes. So you call cathode ray tubes in this chapter the first electronic screens and the first electronic eyes. And this idea of watching and visuality and being watched and surveillance is very, very important to what's happening here. So the chapter looks at the integration of and the use of cathode ray tubes in terms of the technologies of radar screens, of televisions, and you talk in particular about a couple of things that I'd love to ask you to talk a little bit about. One is super selfish of me to ask, and the other is less selfish. So the super selfish thing that I'm going to ask is for you to talk a little bit about oscilloscopes and theremin, like kind of musical instruments and theremins in this period. Mm. The chapter talks about that, and this is selfish because I play a theremin and I have one sitting at home, and I was so, anytime I see anybody writing about theremins, I'm like, yes, we have to talk about that. So can you talk about what's happening in terms of oscilloscopes and electronic music in this period as it relates to your story?
Oh, sure. Well, that's just great. Yay! Because, as a big fan of electronic music, you know, to me, listening to electronic music really helps me think things through. And I thought, you know, how can I bring in something about the history of electronic music to this book about visual representations? I had to work on it. With the oscilloscope, it just, it fit right in because the sound that it makes is so iconic. We can picture the wavy line on an early 20th century round screen that's monitoring an electronic waveform, and we can hear in our mind's ear the way that waveform is going to sound.
I'll do it. Woo! Okay, for listeners who don't know what theremin is, so woo! Okay, I just did it. Okay, go on.
Okay, yeah, right. So I thought I can talk about the history of music here, and the history of music also, it feeds in a lot of different ways because electronic music in the 1930s had a window of time when it was attempted to integrate into kind of mainstream orchestral environments through the work of people like Leopold Stokowski, and it was widely written about in early electronic magazines kind of before electronic technologies were commercialized the way that they later became. Music seemed to be kind of an equal application of technology, and for a while it got equal page space in the radio and electronics magazines, and it, mostly by way of explaining, it was considered to be one major way that electronics was going to be integrated into the culture, and orchestral music sort of decided, against that. And over the decades, electronic music was kind of migrated into its own sphere. But for a while in the 30s, people were explaining oscilloscopes and the monitoring and creative and artistic use of electronic waveforms really widely in musical terms. And that's what I wanted to get at, was that it was a little later that oscilloscopes began to be used to prefigure like video art, where the waveform was manipulated to form visual patterns in visual media. Before that, it was electronic waveforms and the oscilloscope were used as musical instruments, and I just thought that was beautiful and could not go unremarked in this history of technology.
That's right. And there are actually a number of moments, maybe we'll get to some of them in the rest of our hour, but there are a number of moments in which the history of music and musical technologies actually becomes a really important part of this history of the confluence of art and visual representations mm-hmm. and technology. So player pianos come up later and some other issues. So listeners who may not have known that that's also an important part of this story who are interested in the history of music and the intersection between music and technology. Technology will find a lot of interest in the book. So the other thing that's somewhat less selfish, but also I think really important to the chapter that's happening here in the discussion of cathode ray tubes is you're emphasizing the importance of a kind of panopticon effect, right? And these tubes are for watching. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of the story in terms of what you think is really important about the work being done in this chapter?
Sure. One thing that motivates me to study the history of technology is to understand how gestures that we take for granted today came into being and look at the moment right before they were taken for granted. And one of those gestures is our gaze at the screen. And what was the historical moment right before people were socialized to look at screens? And that's where the emergence of the oscilloscope comes in. First, people started watching waveforms, and then, cathode ray tubes became adapted to television. But outside of the kind of popular sphere, they came to become tools of surveillance. And part of this idea that we're part of the work that people do in contemporary society is to sit down and look at a screen and watch what's happening on the screen goes back to the early use of CRTs to display things like radar patterns and, flight monitoring. And then that in the during the Cold War era, of course, those applications took on a proliferation of forms and dramatically increased in scale. And there's this relationship between the history of our surveillance culture of the contemporary era with that process of socialization to the monitor itself. And I found that all very compelling, and the history of the CRT was a way to trace that.
So as we move from here into the next chapter, we move from tubes to crystals. And this is a really fascinating chapter. So this is a chapter that looks at the use and research into the use of crystals and quartz crystals specifically, but not only, in terms of electricity. I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but piezoelectricity?
Piezoelectricity.
Special superpower of mispronunciation.
I mispronounced it for years. When you're only reading the literature and not necessarily talking about it to other historians who've gone before you, I thought, I read it as like pianissimo, piezo. It's actually piezo.
Okay, so piezo electricity and quartz crystals. Now, this chapter is really a model of what can happen when you look at ways and modes of imaging these technologies and pull a story and a narrative out of those modes of imaging. And the narrative that comes out of, or at least part of the narrative that comes out of reading images of crystals and crystallography in this period is a narrative that speaks to the increasing or a kind of special interest in bringing together organic and mechanical imagery. It becomes a narrative about the transformations in visualization that come with microphotography and the ability to see on a new scale. And it's also a story that brings to the fore some actors who we might not otherwise think about too much in the history of science and technology. And this is, again, speaking to the issue of trying not to take for granted still, the things that we take for granted or the people that we take for granted. And this is the importance of staff artists, right? So some of these companies, like General Electric, for example, actually employed artists on their staff. And you bring us into the work of one of them in particular, Ken Staley.
Mm-hmm.
So as a way into this chapter, can you maybe talk a little bit about the importance of artists working at these companies in this period? How, for you, did they and do they help shape and change the story in important ways, and perhaps especially with regard to crystals and crystal imaging?
Yeah, the Ken Staley story, I had the good fortune to be able to speak at length with his surviving spouse about his work with General Electric. So I had a live informant to talk to me about that time, and she had also been working at General Electric. And
what's really interesting about Staley's work, both the work itself, is also that he, as an artist, managed to kind of get it seen in the fine arts sphere. And it's cited in popular media. It ended up getting mentioned in, like, both Time and the New Yorker as an, interesting instance of modern art. And it was one of these early he communicated across a number of different worlds that weren't always talking to each other at the time. There were such thick walls between fine and applied art at the time, even though many fine artists worked as applied artists for their day jobs to support their fine arts work. And the work that Staley did for General Electric managed to push through that wall and be seen by multiple audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And to be taken on its own terms as an expression of modern painting.
Mm-hmm.
And that really... there's a history there of microphotography and crystallography in the history of the kind of fine arts understanding of technology. The work that Gregory Tepish did at MIT to convene both talks and courses in the relationship between art and technology had their foundations in a study, photographic studies of microphotography of crystalline structures. And so Staley's work picks up, it continues that tradition, as well as speaking to the kind of larger issues that artists and scientists were both trying to suss out during the 20th century, trying on in their different domains. Different kinds of organic and mechanical ways of framing the work that was being done. And this is interesting in the history of technology that scientists and engineers both tried out different kinds of frames around their work and in different mechanical or organic terms. And that's the exact same question that modern artists were grappling with in the 20th century. Whether the emerging world was, inherently mechanical and had to be represented in angular geometric mechanical terms, or whether mechanization was a skin on top of an underlying deeply organic nature of things that needed to be expressed in kind of rounded biophilic visual terms. And...
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to say, this issue of the confluence of the mechanical and the organic also comes up in the next chapter, right? Did you want to speak to that issue a little bit more before we moved on?
Oh no, we can move on to.
Well, this is
circuits and transistors.
Yeah, well, this is something that comes up in the discussion, I think, of the kind of challenges and strategies for representing the transistor in graphic terms. So you call in Chapter 4 the transistor the single most technologically and culturally significant outcome of early experimentation with crystal structures. And so there's a nice transition from the crystallography and the study of crystals to this study and development of transistors. And you talk in this chapter about, again, some of the ways that graphic artists are imaging transistors and some of the particular challenges that they're facing, given the particular structure of and the shape of this technology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, well, that's really where, the research into crystallography yielded these new properties of crystal forms that they could channel and control the flow of electrons in ways that duplicated and extended the power of vacuum tubes and ultimately, in most contexts, replaced the vacuum tube. But that history, like so many others, took some time to become as self-evident as it appears to us from today's point of view. And while it was unfolding, engineers and scientists worked with artists to try to figure out ways of communicating just what a transistor was and what it could do. And a few artists did try representing it, but, you know, it was this, in keeping with its roots in, you know, microelectronics, the artifact itself was so small that it, even in its early kind of chunky, clunky era, it defied direct visual representation. So while a few artists did try to paint the transistor, the turn to the transistor away from the tube really offered artists an opportunity and in fact demanded that they draw on their skills of abstract visualization to depict the change that the transistor represented. But in this case, the electronics engineers had developed a graphic language for communicating circuit plans. And that graphic language utilized geometric forms in much the same way that modern artists of the mid-20th century were using geometric forms. So there was this kind of accidental and not so accidental convergence of geometric modernism with the circuit symbol language, which goes back to Faraday. The circuit symbol language itself was 150 years old, but it became much more widely promulgated and read and understood by different communities of, everyone from radio repair people to engineers. And so it had a much wider audience in the mid-20th century. And then the artists who were studying the work of engineers and trying to figure out ways of communicating it in visual terms just applied strategies of mid-century geometric modernism to the circuit symbol diagram language and came up with this whole new trope of visual expression of technological change. And
So this intersection between abstract art and the technological arts is also something that we see surfacing in the next chapter. You bring us in the next chapter into the issue of circuit boards. So we move from transistors and circuit symbols to circuit boards themselves. Now, this becomes a really, really interesting point of the story for many reasons. But one of the reasons is that at this point of the book, you explicitly raise an issue and a theme that's going to continue to be important up to the very last pages. And that is the similarity or the relationship or the resonance between electronic tinkering and art making. So you talk about the ways that, for example, a circuit board or the shape of a circuit board evokes the shape of a painter's palette. You talk about the similarities between kind of a home electronics workshop and a home craft bench. So since this seems to be a really important theme in general throughout the work, can you speak a little bit to that, the sort of the similarities in this part of the story between electronic tinkering and making and artistic tinkering and making?
Oh, sure. And, this is something that interests me all the way through the story, but it's really with, there is quite a surprise factor for me in doing the research and coming to understand the extent to which circuit boards were handmade and represented a kind of a home craft tradition that, the extent to which was, revelatory to me as a historian, I didn't know about. Going back to the history of electronic music, in the course of this research, I came through the research done by Carolyn Martell into the history of the On Martineau, an electronic music instrument. I came to understand that people who build those instruments are still today making circuit boards by hand in home workshops. And you know, so partly because of those discoveries, I felt that this chapter was the right place to foreground this kind of other aspect of the relationship between art and technology, where they're, you know, in a number of ways, they're emerging in parallel process to one another and have a number of kind of operational features in common with one another. And, you know, I found in a broader sense, this book is about a number of different kind of underrepresented points of connectivity between art and technology, and this was the right place to bring in that particular part of the story. And the process of automation, it anticipates the discussion that follows of automation, and that in the especially with circuit boards, automation unfolded a little less regularly than I might have expected. And the kind of the craft bench tradition is very persistent, and it has a number of its just basic tools in common with, you know, with craft benches.
Mm-hmm. So let's actually keep going along these lines.
Okay.
And kind of move into the next chapter. Mm-hmm. But also there's another important shift to mark at this point of the book, as we move from circuit boards to the emergence of computing. And you mark this at this point in, I think at the end of the chapter, we have a shift at this point of the story from radios to computers. So that's one shift.
That's true.
And there's another important shift from ground-based technologies to space-based technologies. And so we're going to see that coming up, literally coming up, right, in terms of the kinds of images that we'll see in the second part of the book, or rather in the second half in these later chapters. So chapter 6 takes us into the emergence of computing. There's so much happening in this chapter that we could talk about, and that will really just kind of scratch the surface, right, of this part of the story. But one really interesting thing that's happening in terms of this transition to computing is there's a visual transition in terms of the imaging that you're looking at and the imaging practices to a way of imaging digitality. Right. And this comes up in a number of different kinds of visual tropes. Those include the abacus, right, the image of the abacus as a way of rendering the digital, and also the imaging of punched cards as ways of imaging the digital. So as a way to kind of open up this chapter for us, can you speak to what you think is most interesting and important about the way that the digital and digitality is imaged in the work that's foregrounded in this chapter?
Sure. Well, as the circuit board chapter concludes, the technology became, you know, more about processes that were invisible to the eye than processes that were visible, and artists had to adapt to that. And the circuit board ends up as a kind of template for abstract modern design, and that kind of carries into the chapter on automation and the emergence of computing. And it is a real turning point in the middle of the book, or just past the midpoint, where the leading expressive technology goes from being radios to being computing. You know, in the first half of the 20th century, electronics, the term electronics was kind of code for radio communications. You know, that was the leading edge of it. And that changed in the early 1950s with the emergence of mainframe computing industries. And I mean, it changed slowly over the course of the 1950s. And then what you see is artists grappling with the new output of these new machines, machines that were combined from, you know, all different kinds of technological antecedents in information processing and in scientific calculation, and how to explain the, you know, the emergence of information as a product, but at the same time, the as you say, the computing technology was becoming digitized, or digitalized in the sense of being made into a digital system from an analog system. And radio was an analog technology, but scientific calculation with its antecedents in wartime, you know, calculating machines was a binary digital technology. And so artists reached for abacuses and also various visual motifs associated with the dot patterns on paper tape and the shape and the dot patterns in punched cards to communicate the idea of the process of a system going from being analog to being digital. And they, you know, what's beautiful about the abacus is it also captures this idea that history was at a turning point when systems of when electronic communication technologies went from they continued to be analog, but computers emerged and became digital, and that we needed a different way of understanding, you know, different from waveforms, just how the technology was working. And the abacus expresses that idea of, you know, it being a historical turning point. And then the, those dot patterns in the paper tape and the the punched cards, again, like the circuit diagrams, they take quite easily to the abstract turn in graphic modernism.
Mm-hmm. And this sort of turn toward the incorporation or this abstract turn, right? And the turn toward the incorporation of abstract symbols is something that we see in really, really interesting ways coming up in the next chapter as well. So this is a chapter 7, that looks, among other things, at typographic artwork. It looks at the work with numbers and alphabetical symbols and mathematical symbols in the graphic arts. It brings us into the use of number strings, evoking countdowns, right? We talked about space travel a little bit, or the kind of move to space. It talks about here a kind of poetics of navigation. So in a really beautiful way, poetry, a concrete poetry, and the confluence of not just visual arts and technology, but also audible arts and the poetic arts come in and become part of the same story in chapter 7. I love chapter 7. And we can talk about chapter 7, right, for the rest of the time. But what I want to do is just kind of mark another thing that's going on in chapter 7 that's really important for the story. And this is the way that you bring us into a particular site of production that's really important. And that is Lincoln Labs at MIT. Now, the chapter talks about the importance of Lincoln Labs at MIT as a site for computing innovation, but also as a site for graphic innovation. And that graphic innovation is happening at the hands of Jacqueline Casey, a particular artist who also comes up earlier in the book, but really is given center stage here in chapter 7. So could you talk a little bit about that for you? What's most important for us to understand about Lincoln Labs and the work of Jacqueline Casey in this part of the story?
Sure. I was just so moved to find language coming into center stage as as a writer and someone who's studied linguistics and poetry, and to find a different kind of visual poetry and expressions of concrete poetry put in service of communication of technology. It really moved me, and it's my favorite chapter 2. I shouldn't have favorites, but broadly, the artists who used visible language, typographic forms, were drawing on work pioneered by Italian futurists in the early 20th century, but then doing something totally new with typographic design, which was actually causing it to convey very specific messages about changes in technology. And there's, you can and they encoded to some extent the history of the computing industry and the way different forms of number and word strings were combined in the art. And that was really revelatory to me. And of course, the work done at MIT is unparalleled in its breadth and depth of research. And MIT also had a house graphic design community that was led by Muriel Cooper in the design services office, which was at the time the Office of Publications. And Jacqueline Casey worked with Cooper, and she'd been taught by a Swiss modernist. And what, you know, her work for the MIT Office of Publications is fairly well known, but what I'm studying here is work that she did for the Lincoln Laboratories, which is in a separate site and has its own separate publications. And the work that she's doing for the laboratory here was recruitment posters. And I've not found these particular posters represented or interpreted elsewhere. So I took some time to really focus on them. And especially in this case, in figure 715, Casey actually brings together in totally innovative terms the same kinds of animating ideas that were motivating Herbert Beyer back in chapter one to make that crazy earth bulb, the vacuum tube with the planet at the center. In Casey's design, that's actually an 8-column collage of scientific and technical papers, she pulled in all the same kinds of elements. There are technical papers on the motion of the spheres and of the electron microscopy. So she's playing with the tension between the electron and the solar system in their scale, and also mixing in different elements, graphic elements that express the emergence of computing and the need for people to come work on the IBM 709. And also she picks technical papers that include diagrams that have very rounded soft shapes as right alongside straight line number and logarithmic diagrams, and so that the tension there between organic and mechanical visual forms, I mean, she kind of just pulls it all together, all these motifs, and in a way she makes less essential the role of the artist by suggesting that the technology doesn't need art to be made about it, that if it's arranged correctly, the evidence of the work of scientists is its own art. And, so in a way, her work here in this chapter is a narrative climax of the book, because after this image, which is from 1963, photography becomes ascendant, and the role of the designer, the graphic designer anyway, begins to recede a little bit. So
it's really important, and a couple of things at least that have come up in your description of Jacqueline Casey's work, I just want to mark, because they're important, I think, throughout the book. One of them is, and this is just interesting to me, the use of collage as a methodology, which is something that we see actually in a number of places. It's really interesting. And also the importance of women to this story. The book is very careful to highlight, especially in this chapter, the importance of women to computing, the importance of women to this story, even when we don't always have the named sources to be able to locate and appreciate all of the ways that women are shaping this story. Where there are opportunities to do so, the book is very careful to do so. So I appreciated that. I think that's an important part of the work that the book is doing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, Jacqueline Casey is actually the only woman artist that I've been able to learn about who was doing this kind of work for industry.
But the book marks that explicitly as an issue, right? I mean, rather than just kind of just, you know, telling her story and then moving on, even for drawing our attention to the importance of, you know, as we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, artistic anonymity, and the, you know, the imaging of women in some of these advertisements, you know, the book makes it an issue rather than just kind of touching on it and moving on in a way that I think is really important. So as we move on into the last couple of chapters of the book, we move more and more into space. So chapter 8 looks at the artwork, among other things, that was associated with promoting and recruiting for space programs. And you talk about a number of things related to this, right? The narratives of heroism and of exploration that are rendered visually in the graphic objects associated with this promotion and recruitment. But you all, you talk about science fiction themed graphic art to kind of put in a plug for something we talked about right at the beginning of our conversation. But you also talk about the human body in a couple of different ways, both the increasingly anthropocentric, as you put it, environment of space electronics, and also depictions of a new kind of electronic body that went along with this this technology. So can you speak to that issue here for you? What's most important for us to understand about the body or bodies and the way that they were rendered artistically and technologically in this part of the story?
Sure. Well, the when electronic technologies actually entered space in the late 1950s, that concluded, or it didn't really conclude, but it it marked a completion point of the promise that electronic technologies belonged in a solar system sort of narrative frame that was articulated as early as 1909, as we heard. And, you know, there's a connection there with kind of making the solar system into a body, a part of the world, our universe, our environment that we as human beings can reach and touch. And the actual space programs, robotic human exploration, civil, military, they each of them expressed in a different way that, you know, we as humans are extending our reach and actually expanding our sense of kind of what the body of our world is, our reachable, touchable world. Part of the book traces that geospatial narrative all the way through, and then that does segue right into our sense of, you know, so what's the elemental kind of physiological understanding of the future of electronic technologies? And focusing the future of electronic technologies in the afterlife of the astronaut, as the next chapter investigates, it picks back up with the idea from the 19th century and early 20th century of that electricity and electromagnetic forces are part of our own human body, and that space exploration is part of exploring our expanded reach. But at the end of the day, the future of electronics, as is proving out today, is going to play out in the forum of the human body itself. And there will be, so the outer directed future in space exploration is mirrored by an inner directed future within the human body. And that's where the book sort of heads towards a conclusion.
That's right. And as we head toward that conclusion and we get into chapter 9, we see that playing out in imaging of electronic brains, in imaging of robots, and in a thematization of bionics. Right. So for listeners who may not understand what bionics means, or specifically how you're using it in this part of the book, can you talk to us about the importance of this notion of bionics as it animates what you're doing here in this conclusion?
Sure. You know, bionics is today a little bit of an archaic term, but it describes accurately the gesture on the part of scientists and engineers in the 1950s to translate notions of cybernetics into a kind of a real world future for the human body. And we haven't mentioned cybernetics, but it was the philosophy, World War II era philosophy of the future of electronic networks and how they would and could affect human society in the future. And the idea that the human life could be improved by integration with electronic networks gave rise to this, what was it, in about 1958, a neologism of this word bionics. And then in the early 1970s, you have at the end of this, space journalist Martin Kaden wrote this novel called Cyborg that is about narrativizing the end of the astronaut program and theorizing the future of space technology in the format of the human body. And that novel became the TV show, The $6 Million Man, but he was referred to as a bionic man. Mm-hmm. And then in the decades since then, the term bionic has become limited to a very restricted sense, and terms like artificial intelligence and are much more ascendant and relevant to how since the 60s our cultural understanding of intelligence theory is playing out. But that old archaic term of bionic does express that kind of historical moment of a utopian promise that, that bionics is the twin to space exploration, and it's going to carry forward in the phase in between human spaceflight programs and as a kind of ground-based understanding of what electronics are going to be.
Mm-hmm. So as we come to the very end of the book kind of concludes by moving us forward. And I'll just mark this as so that listeners know this is there and they can look to the book for more about this. The book closes with some thoughts about the future and a movement toward transhumanism. And it talks about the importance of, again, something that we've already talked a little bit about, which is the realm of crafts and tinkering to the future and transhumanism and their relationships. So as we, did you want to speak to that at all as we kind of come to our conclusion, or would you like to leave that for listeners to explore?
Well, what I really wanted to end the book with was a suggestion to readers that the mechanical model of electronics that ended up prevailing in the late 20th century, I mean, it's self-evident, to many people now, the ways in which that did not serve our planet. It doesn't serve environmental justice. It doesn't serve labor justice. And that, a future for electronic technology, if it's going to kind of break through into the 21st century in a way that lets the planet carry forward, is something of a return to a planetary model of thought. I use that with air quotes around it to refer back to the planetary model of the electron, but to make a very straight suggestion that, the urgent future of electronic technologies right alongside of how they're going to serve our human health and well-being is how they're going to become deproliferated in ways, deproliferate the harm that they're doing to the environment, basically. And that's how I wanted to end the book, with that suggestion to readers to bring it, close the metaphor of the planetary model, and then suggest that the future of electronics, it can't be it never has been and never will be just a utopian narrative of a better life, that it has to be looked at critically, as I think many of the artists do all the way along. But this idea of through the book looking at technology from all kinds of different and forgotten vantage points, the one most important way to let that inform how we continue to view technology is through that constructively critical frame of kind of smart deproliferation of environmentally unsustainable production.
So Megan, now that we're at the end of the book, of course, there's a million billion things, right, that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything specific that we didn't talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Oh, just that this book is a real joy for me to work on, and that, you know, I hope that that's expressed in the journey, and that the enthusiasm for that. I still think that, for instance, thinking about technology, society, and culture in geospatial terms is highly generative, and there are lots of different ways to put that frame to work to explore things in new light. And just how enthusiastic I am.
I think that comes out definitely in the course of reading the book and reading the images as well as reading the text. So now that the book is out, what's currently occupying you? What are you working on right now?
Well, lots of things. As mentioned at the beginning, I'm working on our library, collection development and project, you know, development in all kinds of ways. And then one thing that I discovered in the course of researching this book is the role of sponsored moving images in conveying changes in technology. And I'm doing a research project now to explore and understand sponsored cinema, basically corporate movies that were made to explain technology, and looking at ways that animation and straight documentary representation were put in service of explaining new technologies, and just trying to map that out.
Well, best of luck with that. That also sounds like a super fascinating project. And thanks so much for taking time away from that work to talk with me today, Megan. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Carla. It's a real pleasure, too, and an honor to be on your program.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.